At first, Van Buren sought to work this plan through Secretary of State William Crawford of Georgia. Crawford was Van Buren's candidate for the presidency in 1824. But when Crawford suffered a stroke and fared poorly in the balloting, Van Buren switched his allegiance to another man of the South, Andrew Jackson. Van Buren knew Jackson. The two got to know each other when they were both in the Senate together. Jackson didn't make it to the Oval Office that year, but 4 years later, he rode the North-South alliance that Van Buren painstakingly assembled all the way to the White House. This is the official story, the one little thing which turns out to be the most important thing that the progressive narrative leaves out is, on what basis did Van Buren convince Virginia to go along with New York? How did he woo the South to join his Northern alliance? Here the progressives resort to mumbo-jumbo, invoking Van Buren's political perspicuity, his patient courting of Calhoun and other Southerners, his assiduous vote-counting abilities, and his indisputable personal charm and savoir-faire. His magic trick explained. Without discounting Van Buren's abilities, however, we have to read between the lines of these progressive narratives to figure out how Van Buren really sold the South on his grand unification plan. He did so by making several trips to the South in the period from 1822 to 1828. In 1822, Van Buren announced he was making a visit to Jefferson's Monticello in Virginia. He went to Virginia, but he didn't go to Monticello. Van Buren was actually on other business. He seems instead to have secretly visited Thomas Ritchie, the editor of the Richmond Inquirer. I say secretly because there is no formal record of the visit, yet we know it took place because Ritchie alluded to it in subsequent articles. Ritchie was the head of the Richmond Junto, which controlled politics in Virginia and undoubtedly one of the most powerful political figures in the state. His newspaper was a ferocious defender of the interests of the slaveholding class. Van Buren cultivated Ritchie, proposing to him a union between his Albany Regency machine in New York and the Richmond Junto. In this way, Van Buren sought to create the beginnings of a powerful North-South coalition that could vanquish any political rival. Ritchie was interested, but noncommittal. He was sold on Van Buren, whom he praised as a friend and a statesman, but not sold on the bargain. In particular, Ritchie was unconvinced about what benefits such a bargain would bring to the planter interests that the Richmond Inquirer so aggressively promoted. Van Buren failed the first time, but he didn't give up. In 1826, as Andrew Jackson prepared to run a second time, he was thwarted in 1824 by what he termed a corrupt bargain between Henry Clay and John Quincy Adams that put Adams in the White House. Van Buren announced that he was making an extensive tour through the South, visiting Virginia, North Carolina, South Carolina, and Georgia. He didn't get to all those places because, as it turns out, he didn't need to. Van Buren spent the Christmas holidays of 1826 making a deal with Calhoun at the home of their mutual friend William Fitzhugh of Virginia. The details of the bargain are not known, but it is known that Calhoun was satisfied and agreed to back Van Buren's candidate, Andrew Jackson, for the presidency in 1828. Van Buren then drafted a letter to Thomas Ritchie proposing a formal alliance between his New York Regency and the Richmond Junto. Van Buren's progressive admirers focus on their man's blueprint for a new party united behind General Jackson's personal popularity as a war hero who had supposedly been cheated of the presidency the last time around. Van Buren also called for a new political organization that would substitute party principle for personal preference. We can see in this 1827 letter to Ritchie the first traces of the new Democratic Party that existed in Van Buren's head before it existed in reality. Yet Van Buren did not hesitate this time to spell out for Ritchie what this new party would deliver for the planter class. It would recruit the political power of the North to the protection of slave interests in the South. This is the bombshell, only partially concealed in Van Buren's letter by his antiquated and somewhat overbearing rhetoric. Van Buren argued that party attachment, by producing counteracting feelings was an antidote to Northern sectional prejudice against the South. Absent party attachments, the clamor against the Southern influence in African slavery was bound to gain momentum in the North. Van Buren proposed that his new intersectional alliance take on the role of defeating that momentum through its shared ideological commitment to the planter interests of the South. Imagine, Van Buren said, an attack by anti-slavery men on Southerners who were also members of this new party. Naturally, he promised, Northerners belonging to that party would rush to the Southerners' defense, regarding the attack as assaults upon their political brethren and resented accordingly. The planters sought to uphold their peculiar institution, and the creation of a new party alliance along the lines proposed by Van Buren would be eminently serviceable in effecting that object. This is incriminating stuff, very inconvenient to report in a laudatory biography, so Remini rushes to assure us that it would be a mistake to interpret Van Buren's words as a defense of the slave system of the South. Strictly speaking, this is true. Van Buren was not himself pro-slavery. His family had owned a handful of slaves, and Van Buren himself owned a slave named Tom before he ran away. We may say of Van Buren what we might say of the younger Democrat Stephen Douglas, who would rise to prominence in the 1850s. Neither of them cared whether slavery was voted up or down. What Lincoln said later of Douglas, that he had no very vivid impression that the Negro is a human, would also apply to Van Buren. He was an unscrupulous man in the process of creating an unscrupulous party. Van Buren's interest in the planter class of the South was merely political. He needed a national coalition, and they were the ones who supplied the Southern power that Van Buren needed to fuse with the power of his New York Regency. Yes, it could be called the Coalition to Protect Slavery, but had the Southern powers been cannibals instead, Van Buren would willingly have created the Coalition to Protect Cannibalism. Ritchie was sold on the deal, so it seems was Calhoun. No doubt Van Buren pitched his scheme to others, and they shook hands on it. The planter class was in. Van Buren was elated. He had pulled it off. By making them an offer they could not refuse, Van Buren had united the planter class of the South with his own, as we will see, equally grasping an opportunistic political establishment in the North. The political realignment that Van Buren sought was now underway. Progressives seek to portray Van Buren's achievement differently. His remodeling of Jefferson's party, writes Robert Remini, constituted a major step in transferring the government from the control of the few to the many. This is the usual left-wing balderdash, aimed at camouflaging a sordid deal between elites, specifically the sordid pact that Van Buren actually made with the forces of slavery and exploitation. So this was Van Buren's achievement, yes, I speak sarcastically, in creating the Democratic Party, or the Democracy, as Van Buren and others called it. This party then carried Andrew Jackson to the presidency in 1828 and 1832. Jackson's opposition organized itself into a rival party in 1833 that began to call itself the Whigs in 1834. Now we turn to Van Buren's even greater achievement, I speak even more sarcastically, that defines the modus operandi of the Democratic Party right down to the present. The uprooted. Starting in the mid-19th century and continuing through the early 20th, America experienced one of the largest immigrations in human history. Some 35 million people left their homelands in Europe and moved to the United States. 6 million came from the lands that became the German Empire in 1870. 4.5 million from Ireland, 4 million from Great Britain, almost 5 million from Italy, 2 million from the Scandinavian countries, 3 million from Greece, Macedonia, and Armenia, and 8 million or so more from the East, Poland, Hungary, Slovakia, and the Ukraine. In an epic account of this migration, historian Oscar Handlin terms this group the uprooted. While we think of these people as immigrants, Hanlon shows that most of them were in fact refugees. They were fleeing something. In the case of the Irish, the most destitute of them all, they were fleeing a series of potato famines in the 1840s and early 1850s that had spread the stench of starvation, disease, and death throughout Ireland. So these were the people who washed up on the shores of the United States. They had permanently cut their ties with the past. They had arrived in a new country with little or nothing. Many of these exiles didn't even speak English. They crowded into American cities, which were completely unfamiliar. Many of them were rural peasants in their homelands. They had no transferable job skills. Now denizens of American ghettos, they were scared, confused, and lost. They reached their new homes, Hanlon writes, worn out physically by lack of rest, by poor food, by the constant strain of close cramped quarters, worn out emotionally by the succession of new situations that had crowded in upon them. Yet there was no time to recuperate. The immigrants faced the immediate pressing necessity of finding a livelihood and of adjusting to conditions that were still more novel, unimaginably so. In their misery, Van Buren saw a political opportunity. Van Buren knew these people well. The son of Dutch immigrants, Van Buren was a first-generation American, the first U.S. president to be so. He was also the first ethnic president, not descended from Anglo-Saxon roots. Thus, Van Buren saw America, as I do, both from the outside and from the inside. And seeing the starving hordes, lost souls if there ever were such, wandering aimlessly in cities like New York, Van Buren noticed that they resembled a group that he had become quite familiar with in his travels through the South, American slaves. Van Buren had an idea, one that could only have come from a complex, conniving brain such as his. We have to tread carefully here because nowhere did Van Buren write this idea down. If he did, it must have been in the manuscripts that he, ever the circumspect strategist, subsequently destroyed. Yet the idea can be seen in its implementation. We know, for example, that Lincoln had the idea for the Emancipation Proclamation because of the Emancipation Proclamation he issued. So too with Van Buren, we can see his idea in the thing he built. The blueprint can be inferred from the building itself. So here is Van Buren's idea, which, for all its subtle ingenuity, in its essence was quite simple. Why not recreate the democratic model of the rural plantation in the northern cities? Why not make the new immigrants just as dependent on the Democratic Party in the north as the slaves were dependent on the Democratic planters of the south? Then the two plantation systems would together form the political backbone of the Democratic Party. Such an idea, Van Buren knew, was not a matter of rote application. It would require some creative improvisation, which fortunately for the little magician happened to be his forte. Obviously, the immigrants and refugees were not slaves. They could not be held by force. Also, the new immigrants were white. But the deeper point is that both groups, the immigrants and the slaves, were wretched, impoverished, helpless. Both had experienced the shock of displacement. Family separation was a common experience for these refugees, just as it was for the slaves. The challenges the new immigrants faced were the same. Their great need was to learn how to survive, the first challenge, and then to restore a modicum of security to their lives. As for the immigrants, their whiteness didn't matter. They saw themselves in ethnic terms as Irish, Italians, Jews. Their distinguishing features, Van Buren saw, was a clannish solidarity that was based on their origins. The people in each group huddled together and looked for solace and assistance from fellow countrymen. For many, their countrymen were the only people they could talk to, since they were the only ones that spoke their native language. By necessity, the immigrants sought to meet their challenges not individually, but rather through the communal existence of their ethnic groups. Van Buren saw that the slaves, in a parallel, if not similar, situation, had created precisely this sort of communal solidarity to survive on the plantation. From the immigrant yearning for survival and security that he well understood, and from their collective ethnic identity that he carefully observed, Van Buren realized the possibility for creating the same type of enduring dependency he had witnessed on the slave plantation, but this time in the northern cities. How to do this? Here, Van Buren was in a unique position because in New York, he had already created the first political machine in American history. Leading a group called the Bucktails, so named because they wore deer tails on their hats, Van Buren in 1821 displaced New York's most powerful politician, DeWitt Clinton, and created a powerful machine called the Albany Regency. He did it, biographer Ted Widmer admits in a telling comparison, like a 19th century Vito Corleone. While politicians like DeWitt Clinton based their success on their popularity or on personal political accomplishments, Clinton was a noted abolitionist and the acclaimed champion of the Erie Canal, Van Buren's machine functioned in a different way. Basically, the machine demanded the complete allegiance of organizers and constituents from the state right down to the local level. The machine's agenda became their agenda. The machine told them how to vote and required them to campaign for its entire slate during election periods. Its currency wasn't patriotism. It was party loyalty. Such loyalty required a certain toleration for corruption and even criminal behavior. Machine operatives had to learn to look the other way. No deviation, no backsliding, no independence of mind was permitted. As one Regency man, Silas Wright Jr., vowed, "The first man we see step to the rear, we cut down." In exchange for this devotion, the machine rewarded its members with political and financial patronage. For Van Buren, the treasury was not a fund of tax money accumulated to promote the common good. Rather, it was a prize to be distributed to those who enable politicians like Van Buren to dip their hands into the treasury. Asked to defend Van Buren's patronage policies, William Marcy, a prominent member of the Regency, famously responded, "To the victor belong the spoils." For Van Buren and the Albany Regency, politics wasn't a vocation, it was a business. Thus, long before the immigrants themselves arrived, Van Buren had already created the basic formula for organizing democratic power in the northern cities, which were filling up with immigrants and, over subsequent decades, the children of immigrants. The immigrants could be organized into clans based on their already existing ethnic identification. These clans, Van Buren figured, could then be ruled by Democratic Party bosses who demand ethnic loyalty in exchange for political patronage. This then was the Frankenstein that Van Buren created. He was the inventor of the politics of ethnic mobilization. Other elements would be added later, such as the politics of ethnic resentment, hate masquerading as a campaign of resistance to hate. Yet the basic elements are already there. So Van Buren's democratic urban machine proves to be his most enduring legacy. Although devised by Van Buren as a political complement to the slave plantation, for the purpose of consolidating democratic power in the North as well as the South, one can see here in embryo the Democratic Party as it functions even today. Magnanimity, Tammany style. One can draw a straight line from Van Buren's Albany Regency to the full-fledged democratic machine as epitomized by Tammany Hall. The Regency and Tammany were both in New York, the former based in the city, the latter at the upstate capital in Albany. And eventually there were Tammany-style machines in virtually all the cities, Buffalo, Philadelphia, Chicago, Detroit, and San Francisco. While most of the machines were Irish at first, eventually other ethnic groups were also incorporated or started their own machines. There were even a few Republican machines, such as George Cox's turn-of-the-century machine in Cincinnati and the statewide machine run out of Philadelphia that W.E.B. Du Bois wrote about in the Philadelphia Negro. But the vast majority were Democratic machines that, then as now, delivered the Democratic vote even in predominantly Republican states. Lincoln, for example, won New York State in the 1860 election, but he lost New York City, which was just as much a Democratic stronghold as it is today. In American politics, we should note the continuities no less than the discontinuities. The machines, as we know, were founts of political corruption. Tammany bosses like William Boss Tweed, Richard Croker, and Charles F. Murray ran democratic fiefdoms, dispensing favors and accumulating wealth culled not only from the public sector, but also by coercing private sector corporations to pay under-the-table fees to secure public contracts and project approvals. In Brooklyn, Uncle John McCooey ruled the roost. In Jersey City, Frank, I am the law, Haig. In Kansas City, Tom Pendergast. In Boston, the duo of James Michael Curley and John Honey Fitz Fitzgerald. All of them were Democrats. In his book Machine Made, progressive Terry Galway gives us a window into Boss Tweed's operation in the late 1860s. The great raid on the public treasury was underway. Tweed and his friends raked in millions as they took their cuts from inflated bills for public works projects, including construction of a grand new courthouse and the continued construction of Central Park. Journalists knew about some of this but didn't report on it because many of them had been bought off by Tweed. Only in mid-1871 did the New York Times run an exposé showing how Tweed had billed nearly $3 million for furniture and $500,000 for carpets to outfit the new courthouse, hundreds of thousands of dollars for repairs and alterations paid to a firm with ties to Tweed. A carpenter named George Miller received more than $350,000 for a month's work. Tweed was eventually removed as Grand Boss or Sachem of Tammany and found guilty on corruption charges in 1873. Yet he escaped from Ludlow Street Jail, where he awaited trial, and fled to Cuba and then to Spain, where he was finally apprehended and extradited to the United States. He died in prison in 1878. Galway's account of Tweed malpractices is vivid. Yet it reveals a streak of genuine sympathy for him. Galway knows and approves of the fact that Tweed-like practices, which he calls transactional politics, continue today under the auspices of the modern Democratic Party. The bosses frequently did not hold office themselves, but they controlled those who did. And yes, if you were unswervingly loyal to the Democratic machine, the bosses would help you in whatever way they could, fix your immigration problem or intervene with a local judge, say to get your delinquent son a suspended sentence. Tammany sachems were known for such magnanimities as sustaining widows' lifestyles by keeping their dead husbands on the payroll. Tammany's magnanimity toward widows illustrates how the Democratic urban machines were also employment bureaus. They got their people jobs, whether or not the workers actually did anything useful. The point was to keep them and their families on the payroll, so that their loyalty to the Democratic Party would be continuing and secure. How well people like FDR, LBJ, and Obama would have fit in as city bosses had they lived in the Tammany era. And it's no wonder that progressive chroniclers of Tammany are sympathetic to bosses who engaged in practices that progressives themselves advocate on behalf of the federal government today. I am no more impressed by progressive accounts of good bosses than I am by earlier Democratic invocations of the good slave master. We should remember that the Democratic bosses always got the largest share of the heist. Boss Tweed of Tammany accumulated a vast fortune for himself before finally being convicted and sent to prison. And even Tammany underboss George Washington Plunkett parlayed his influence to hold down four public offices at the same time and become a multimillionaire. And every machine generosity was at someone else's expense. The bosses never paid out of their own pocket. Moreover, if you crossed the bosses in any way, they would make sure you suffered for it. Election rigging. Just as tightly as the Democratic bosses controlled political appointments and the dispensing of patronage, they also controlled the voting process. In several cities, including New York, the bosses didn't rely on immigrants to vote correctly. Rather, they supplied the immigrants with filled-in ballots. The immigrants then showed up at the voting booth, where they were handed empty ballots. When the supervisor was not looking, they would simply substitute the filled-in ballot for the empty ballot. Thus, outcomes were assured for Democratic bosses. As the machines grew established, they also grew bolder, now going beyond filled-in votes to also deliver dead people's votes in favor of Democratic machine candidates. Here, immigrants would be directed to show up multiple times to vote, sometimes in the names of characters culled from novels or their dead relatives or dead people listed on tombstones in local cemeteries. Tammany carried on in this way for nearly a century, from the 1840s through the 1930s. The bosses could be entertaining. Asked by an investigating committee whether he was working for his own pocket, Tammany boss Richard Croker fired back, "All the time, same as you." Despite this refreshing candor, I find it strange to read the progressive peons to these Tammany thugs. Progressives seem to think that what they did was quite amusing, and although pushing the envelope in terms of legality, nevertheless healthy for democracy. I notice a high tolerance for pork barrel schemes that are, even now, viewed as a normal way of conducting politics in a democracy. Progressives do not seem overly concerned that politicians are looting the treasury, and no one seems to be minding the store on behalf of the hapless taxpayer. While progressives admit that the Democratic urban machines were a for-profit enterprise, thoroughly imbued with corruption and election rigging, they insist, as Widmer says, that the bosses gave immigrants a voice. Yet this voice was nothing more than the ventriloquist preferences of the bosses themselves. The ethnic exploitation of vulnerable people and the callous use of their votes to rip off the general population are somehow presented as triumphs of democratic inclusion. I suspect that progressive sympathies for such exploitation are based on the realization that not very much has changed, and that modern-day progressives are into the same sorts of rackets. Even today, as we saw in the 2016 Hillary-Bernie contest, the Democrats are not above rigging elections, even while accusing Trump of electoral collusion. And Democratic resistance to voter identification laws seems to be less based on the honest conviction that poor people cannot produce valid IDs than on the Democrats' shared belief that now, as in the Tammany era, a vote is a vote, regardless of whether it comes from an illegal, a dead guy, or a fictional character. In reality, this type of Democratic Party corruption and election rigging was, and is, a thorough perversion of the democratic process. Even more, the whole basis of Tammany and the democratic urban machine is a usurpation of the political system that the founders created. I don't mean this in the sense that the founders failed to create a party system, and Van Buren did. The party system was not anticipated by the founders, but by itself is not incongruent with the founders' novus ordo seclorum. Nor do I mean it in the sense that the founders created a nation with a homogeneous population and Van Buren's machine was based on organizing ethnically diverse people. Yes, Book 2 of the Federalist declares that Providence has been pleased to give this one connected country to one united people, a people descended from the same ancestors, speaking the same language, professing the same religion, very similar in their manners and customs. It was not to be. Yet ethnic diversity by itself can be accommodated in the founding scheme. As Lincoln recognized, the founders wisely framed their arguments in universalistic terms. Not all Englishmen or all Anglo-Saxons are created equal, but rather all men. In 1858, Lincoln said, "Perhaps half our people have come from Europe, German, Irish, French, and Scandinavian. These people did not," Lincoln admits, "have anything to do with writing the Declaration of Independence, ratifying a constitution. In this sense, they might feel excluded from the founding bargain of their new country." Yet when they read the Declaration, Lincoln said, they see that it applies also to them. Then they recognize that they have a right to claim it as though they were blood of the blood and flesh of the men who wrote the Declaration. And so they are. The Declaration's teaching that all are created equal, Lincoln said, is the electric cord in that Declaration that links the hearts of patriotic and liberty-loving men together. So ethnic diversity can be integrated within an inclusive American nationalism. The real perversion lies elsewhere. We can see it by consulting Book 10 of The Federalist, where Madison considers what he calls the problem of faction. Madison, like the other founders, worried about subgroups or factions motivated by particular interests conspiring against the public treasury and the public interest. Madison considered factions of this sort incompatible with the republican form of government. How, he asked, can America protect itself against them? Madison's solution was the constitutional republic itself. Minority factions, he said, would be voted down by a majority. Moreover, in a large extended republic like America, Madison predicted that while there may be a multiplicity of factions, organized perhaps around regional claims or occupational interests, none would be strong enough to steal the public purse or achieve its particular good over and against the public good. Madison was confident that any faction that attempted such sinister designs would surely be thwarted by other factions that would see through its nefarious scheme. Working at the state level rather than the federal, Van Buren showed how Madison's Republican remedy could be defeated. Van Buren demonstrated how factions could indeed prevail, how particular goods could in fact vanquish the public good. The solution involved rigging the democratic process through ethnic stooges, suckers really, who would deliver the vote on behalf of helpless, dependent populations. These populations would be courted through favors and then, when they did what was expected of them, rewarded through nepotism and patronage. The key was to keep these ethnic populations so dependent that they would continually retain the corrupt democratic machine in power. The democratic machine would then work assiduously, not for any public good, but rather for the particular good of the ethnic constituencies under its sway. Van Buren went on to an undistinguished presidency marked by economic depression and what even progressive historians now concede is the disgrace of supervising the notorious displacement of the Cherokee, an event otherwise known as the Trail of Tears. Perhaps repenting of his previous Faustian pacts with slavery, Van Buren joined the Free Soil movement and made an abortive third run for president in 1848. He was soundly defeated. In his later years, while no longer a partisan for the plantation, he refused to follow the Free Soil Democrats who left the Democratic Party and joined the Republicans. Van Buren stayed a lifelong Democrat. The Tammany system was challenged by reformers in the late 19th century and finally routed by progressives in the early 20th century. Working through a Republican ally, Fiorello LaGuardia, FDR finally crushed Tammany and in general brought down the urban machines. As Jay Cost shows in his recent book, A Republic No More, FDR's motives were hardly pure. Rather, his intention was not to get rid of the machine, but to substitute a national machine for the various local ethnic machines. Not to eliminate corruption, but to legalize it and make it a permanent feature of our government. FDR replaced several local scams with one big national scam. Much has changed. The Democrats gave up their system of ethnic mobilization under Franklin Roosevelt in the 1930s, then took it up again under Lyndon Johnson in the 1960s. Today, Democrats don't bother to mobilize white ethnics anymore. They have moved on to other groups, blacks, Latinos, feminists, homosexuals. Yet, as Plunkett says, the Democratic Party can't die while it's got Tammany for its backbone. In a sense, Tammany remains the backbone of the Democrats. The old Tammany regime is gone, but what Tammany represents, the dehumanizing system of democratic ethnic exploitation that Van Buren created, is still very much with us today. Chapter 5. The Plantation in Crisis. How Democrats North and South fought to extend slavery. What did we go to war for but to protect our property? Alexander Stevens, Democrat and Vice President of the Confederacy. One of the most powerful weapons of historical revisionism is silence. From ancient times, the wise have recognized the uses of silence. In Plato's Republic, Socrates convinces Glaucon that Greeks should not enslave other Greeks. Glaucon reluctantly goes along, but then blurts out that surely it's fine for Greeks to enslave barbarians. This assertion, Plato informs us, Socrates greeted only with silence. In this case, Socrates' silence is prudential. He has gone as far as he can go to convince Glaucon. To attempt to go further is to risk losing what has painstakingly been accomplished. Then there is Lincoln's silence during the Great Secession Winter of 1860-61. There was a four-month interregnum between Lincoln's election and his inauguration. And during this period, several states seceded, and in a panic, Democrats as well as some Republicans considered various proposed measures to appease the South and prevent a civil war. The most famous of these was the Crittenden proposal, which would have extended the Missouri Compromise line across to the Pacific, allowing slavery permanently south of the line and prohibiting it north of it. While there was strong pressure on Lincoln to react publicly to these proposed measures, he said nothing while working behind the scenes to defeat them. Thus, Lincoln's silence, like that of Socrates, was in service of prudence. He had to wait until he was inaugurated to have the power to actually implement the mandate he had just won. While I have just given two instances of the noble use of silence, this chapter focuses on a very ignoble use of silence to distort historical truth. Here I focus on progressive revisionism about the Civil War and Reconstruction. The purpose of this revisionism is to blame the conflict mostly on the South, and to blame the South again for the postbellum resistance to Northern Reconstruction. What is left out of this narrative is the role of the Democratic Party. This is how silence can be used, not passively to withhold information, but actively to deceive. For example, in both of Ta-Nehisi Coates' books, and in his numerous articles for The Atlantic, there is no mention of the Democratic Party affiliation of the Confederates. They are typically named as Southerners, not as Democrats. This is particularly interesting because Coates is himself a Democrat, and he apparently has no intention of holding his party responsible for its historical crimes, even though those are precisely the crimes for which Coates seeks reparations and restitution. Coates does not wish to explain why he continues to belong to a party that perpetuated the very offenses about which he is apparently inconsolable. So Coates disingenuously uses silence to serve his ideological purpose, which is to shift the blame to Trump and the Republican right. But the pattern goes even deeper. Coates and the historians he relies on, figures such as Barbara Fields, Annette Gordon Reed, and Eric Foner, go beyond minimizing the Democratic affiliation of Southern apologists for slavery. They also leave out, or at the very least downplay, the role of the Northern Democrats in upholding slavery before and during the Civil War, and then reestablishing a form of neo-slavery in the South after the war. This use of silence here is critical, because to implicate the Northern Democrats is to undermine the progressive narrative that assigns virtually exclusive culpability to the South. Ultimately, progressives seek to cast blame not merely on the South, but also on America. In this way, they can smear the Republicans, whose base is in the South, and who see themselves as reviving an American nationalism. So in addition to blaming the South, the current base of the GOP, progressives also cast some of the blame on Abraham Lincoln. Yes, Abraham Lincoln. Leading figures of modern-day historiography, including George Frederickson and Fred Kaplan, not to mention progressive outlets like the Huffington Post, fault Lincoln with being a bit of a racist, not quite as enlightened as progressives themselves. A sample work in this genre is Lerone Bennett's Forced into Glory, Abraham Lincoln's White Dream, which presses the case for Lincoln being a racist by raising all the familiar issues. Didn't Lincoln say that if he could save the Union without freeing a single slave, he would do it? Didn't Lincoln emphasize in his debates with Douglas that he did not support social equality or intermarriage between the races? Didn't Lincoln specifically come out against giving blacks voting rights or letting them serve on juries? And didn't Lincoln's celebrated Emancipation Proclamation free the slaves only in the Confederacy, where Lincoln had no power, to free them while not freeing any of the 500,000 slaves in Union states like Maryland, Delaware, Kentucky, and Missouri? Lincoln's words and actions seem the incriminating hallmarks of a racist, if not a full-blown white supremacist. And this progressive indictment of Lincoln may be responsible for the vandals who defaced the Lincoln statue as part of their campaign to take down or destroy racist monuments. They might well have been the acolytes of Coates or of Reconstruction historian Eric Foner, who emphasizes that not only is Lincoln guilty, the whole nation is guilty, even though the main effort is in the South. Foner is one of the most subtle, cunning revisionists of the left. Here from his magnum opus, Reconstruction, are a few telling sentences. Conservatives, however, were not the only delegates to raise questions of social equality. In Foner's bizarre nomenclature, Southern Democrats who oppose equality are conservatives. By contrast, on the party's left stood the radical Republicans. Incredibly, the most zealous Republicans are now positioned on the left. And then, long into the 20th century, the South remained a one-party region under the control of a reactionary ruling elite. Somehow, the Democratic racist ruling class of the South is classified as a group of right-wing reactionaries, the natural predecessors, in Foner's view, to Trump, the GOP, and modern-day conservatives. One inaccuracy on top of another. Clearly, I have my work cut out from me. And my task is made even more complex by the fact that modern progressive revisionism about the Civil War and Reconstruction was preceded by a separate democratic and progressive revisionism that developed in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. Immediately following the war and Reconstruction, Democrats got to work fashioning a narrative of concealment aimed at fooling future generations about what had just happened. The old lies and the new historical accounts parallel each other. The lying democratic narratives of the past sitting alongside the sanitized progressive narratives of the present. But they are not the same. The old democratic liars pretended that the Civil War was not about slavery. Here the classic examples are Alexander Stevens and Jefferson Davis, who were respectively the vice president and president of the Confederacy. Two decades after the war, Davis insisted that African servitude was in no wise the cause of the conflict, but only an incident. Stevens portrayed the war as a strife between the principles of federation on the one side and centralism or consolidation on the other. Slavery, so-called, was but the question on which these antagonistic principles were finally brought into actual and active collision with one another on the field of battle. Davis and Stevens appear to us as creatures of the distant past. Can we reasonably link them with the progressive Democrats who came of age a few decades later in the early 20th century? Yes, we can. We see a very similar understanding of the Civil War promoted in the early 20th century by the progressive historians Charles and Mary Beard. The Beards, who agreed with Davis and Stevens that slavery had little or nothing to do with the war, famously coined the term Second American Revolution to characterize the shift of power caused by the war from the planter aristocracy of the South to northern capitalists and free farmers. The same period saw the rise of the so-called Dunning School, named after William Dunning and his colleagues at Columbia University, which portrayed Reconstruction as a vicious, intrusive, Republican effort to impose Negro rule on the South, happily thwarted by independence-loving Southern Democrats who brought the uppity blacks under heel and sent the no-good Republican carpetbaggers packing. It comes with some surprise for us to discover that Dunning and his colleagues saw themselves as progressives and regarded themselves as writing progressive history. Blowing these Democratic big lies out of the water and exposing the truth, that is my task here. First, I show that the Civil War arose not out of a North-South debate, but rather out of a bitter struggle between a Republican Party that sought to block the spread of slavery and a Democratic Party, North and South, that sought to continue it. Then I show the role of the Northern Democrats, even during the war, to undermine the Union war effort, to force a peace treaty with the South, and to give slavery a permanent place in America's future. When this failed, I show how the Northern Democrats attempted to block the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments and worked closely with the Southern Democrats to defeat Reconstruction, which was a Republican project to create multicultural democracy in America. Instead, the Democrats deployed a new weapon, racial terrorism, to disperse white Republicans, subjugate blacks, and reestablish their political hegemony in the South. The difference between the two parties. On December 22, 1860, in a final effort to avert the looming prospect of civil war, Abraham Lincoln wrote a brief note to his former colleague, Alexander Stephens of Georgia, soon to become Vice President of the Confederacy. Both Lincoln and Stephens had been Whigs, and they had worked together in opposition to the Mexican War and other issues. They respected each other. Moreover, Stephens had in his native Georgia given an impassioned speech opposing secession, arguing that despite the election of a Republican president, slavery would be much more secure in the Union than out of it. Lincoln admired the speech so much that he had requested an official copy of the transcript. If there was ever a chance that two men, one a Northerner, the other a Southerner, could work things out, this was it. Lincoln reassured Stephens that, as his campaign statements repeatedly stressed, and as the Republican platform made absolutely clear, the new government had no intention of interfering with slavery in the states where it already existed. The South would be in no more danger in this respect, Lincoln wrote, than it was in the days of Washington. Then Lincoln added tellingly, "I suppose, however, that this does not meet the case. You think slavery is right and ought to be extended, while we think it is wrong and ought to be restricted. That, I suppose, is the rub. It certainly is the only substantial difference between us." And upon this difference, as Lincoln dolefully predicted, America went to war with itself in the following year. As Stephens undoubtedly knew at the time, but which has been subsequently muddied by progressive scholarship, Lincoln was not actually distinguishing the positions of the North versus the South. The North certainly did not unanimously share the view that slavery was wrong. Only Republicans in the North held that position. Democrats in the North, Stephen Douglas notably among them, emphatically rejected that view. Northern Democrats, led by Douglas, contested the 1860 election against Lincoln on the basis of that disagreement. That the slavery debate was not a North-South debate, but rather a partisan debate, can be verified by the startling truth I first reported in Hillary's America that has gone unchallenged since. In 1860, at the time Lincoln wrote this letter, no Republican owned a slave. I don't mean merely that no Republican leader owned a slave. No Republican in the country owned a slave. All the slaves in the United States at the time, all 4 million of them, were owned by Democrats. Stephens himself crossed over from the Whigs to the Democratic Party in 1855, 5 years prior to the Civil War. In the years leading up to the war, in multiple addresses, and in the Lincoln-Douglas debates, Lincoln himself stressed the main issue that separated the two parties. "The difference between the Republican and the Democratic parties," Lincoln said in a September 11, 1858 speech at Edwardsville, Illinois, is that the former consider slavery a moral, social, and political wrong, while the latter do not consider it either a moral, social, or political wrong. Keeping Douglass's popular sovereignty in mind, Lincoln added, "I will not allege that the Democratic Party considers slavery morally, socially, and politically right, although their tendency to that view has, in my opinion, been constant and unmistakable. Up to the Dred Scott decision, where, it seems to me, the idea is boldly suggested that slavery is better than freedom." The Republican Party, Lincoln continued, hold that this government was instituted to secure the blessings of freedom, and that slavery is an unqualified evil to the Negro, to the white man, to the soil, and to the state. They will use every constitutional method to prevent the evil from becoming larger, and will oppose in all its length and breadth the modern democratic idea that slavery is as good as freedom and ought to have room for expansion all over the continent. This is the difference, Lincoln concluded, as I understand it, between the Republican and Democratic parties. And Lincoln repeated his same description of the Democrats in the sixth debate with Douglas at Quincy, and in the following debate at Alton. Nor did Douglas contest his opponent's understanding of the core division between the parties. Unlike his successor Democrats of today, Douglas had no interest in concealing his own position or in blaming the defense of slavery solely on the South. The strategy of the Democrats, both in the 1858 Senate contest and in the 1860 presidential campaign, was to launch racist attacks against Lincoln and the Republican Party. Democrats routinely called Republicans black Republicans, nigger lovers, and woolly heads. We can find online Democratic posters contrasting the prototypical dignified Democratic white man with the menacing stereotypical Republican Negro. In 1858, the Democratic Chicago Times warned that if Lincoln were elected senator, Illinois would become the nigger state of the Northwest. In 1860, Democrats spread the false rumor that Hannibal Hamlin, himself a former Democrat who had quit the party in disgust over its pro-slavery position and was now vice presidential candidate of the Republican Party, was half-black. A Democratic campaign banner in New York claimed that "free love and free niggers will certainly elect old Abe." Both in 1858 and 1860, Douglas appealed to racist sentiments among the electorate in accusing Lincoln of supporting intermarriage and social equality between the races, not to mention of favoring blacks having the right to vote and to serve on juries. Lincoln's response to these attacks shows the manner in which he embodied the philosophical statesmanship of the founders. Indeed, Lincoln's plight was eerily similar to that of the founders. Just as they inherited slavery and had to figure out what to do with it, Lincoln was running at a time when racist prejudice against blacks ran strong nationwide, and he had to figure out how to handle it. There was virtually no constituency that believed blacks should be allowed to intermarry or to have social equality with whites. Even Americans who agreed blacks should not be deprived of their natural rights, that they should not be enslaved, strongly opposed the idea that blacks should be immediately granted civil rights, which they saw as an entirely different matter. Natural rights are the prerogative of every human being, conferred, if you will, by nature or by God, while civil rights are granted by the consent of a community that has every right to withhold them if it chooses. If Lincoln were perceived as promoting intermarriage, social equality, or civil rights for blacks, his electoral defeat, both in the 1858 Senate contest and in the 1860 presidential election, was certain. Lincoln had the choice, as the founders did, of going down in flames or taking the strongest anti-slavery stance that was viable to secure the consent of the governed. This stance would involve accommodating racist sentiment while not encouraging it, just as the founders accommodated slavery while not encouraging it, and thus achieving a result that would help create the conditions for the ultimate defeat of both racism and slavery. Consider the artfully conditional way in which Lincoln responded to Douglas. Now, I protest against that counterfeit logic which concludes that because I do not want a black woman for a slave, I must necessarily want her for a wife. I need not have her for either. I can just leave her alone. In some respects, she is certainly not my equal, but in her natural right to eat the bread she earns with her own hands, without asking leave of anyone else, she is my equal, and the equal of all others. Notice how little Lincoln concedes here to racist prejudice. He doesn't say he rejects racial intermarriage. He merely rejects the equation that holds that a man who opposes slavery necessarily endorses racial intermarriage. Lincoln rightly points out that this is a fallacy. One can be for one without being for the other. What Lincoln does here is refuse to be drawn into a side debate about miscegenation. He keeps the focus on the actual policy issue dividing the parties, which is slavery, or more precisely, the extension of slavery. Admittedly, Lincoln, in his Charleston debate on September 18, 1858, said, "I have no purpose to introduce political and social equality between the white and black races." Lincoln also said he did not support the right of blacks to vote or serve on juries. Later, toward the end of the Civil War, Lincoln actually did support, albeit through the democratic process, which is to say through popular consent, the extension of those rights to blacks. Yet in 1858, Lincoln took a position that modern progressives have interpreted to suggest that he too was a white supremacist. Why then would Lincoln bow to racial prejudice in this way? Let us recall Lincoln's admonition to a group of blacks on the eve of the Emancipation Proclamation that freedom would still leave blacks free in a country whose citizens rejected them as equals. If that was true in 1862, it was certainly true earlier. So in denying his intention to give blacks the right to vote and serve on juries, Lincoln was refusing to do what he could not in any case do. For Lincoln, as for the founders, the American people were not yet ready to confer civil rights or social equality on blacks, and thus the granting of such rights must await the readiness of popular consent. Lincoln bowed to popular prejudice because even prejudice must be considered part of the consent of the governed, and because he wanted to be in a leadership position to tame that prejudice in the future. The progressive attack on Lincoln as a white supremacist fails. Nowhere did Lincoln ever say he considered whites to be inherently superior to blacks. The left today condemns Lincoln for taking the course he did without being able to recommend a better one. Blacks secured the right to vote and to serve on juries in large part because of what Lincoln did in assembling a Republican coalition to win the Civil War, and Lincoln's ability to do that was made possible only by his patient determination to get to first base before charging on to second. We can draw from the reasoning above the astonishing conclusion that it was even in the interest of blacks for Lincoln to deny their right to social equality in the 1858 and 1860 campaigns because the alternative course, the one seemingly advocated by modern-day progressives, would have assured his defeat and consigned him to political oblivion, and that would have surely resulted in a much longer delay for blacks to secure their freedom, let alone any additional rights and privileges that would be granted through amendments to the original Constitution. The Confederacy's Northern Allies. The Civil War was a deliberate attempt by the Democratic Party, both in the North and the South, to kill America by carving her into two. Had secession worked, Lincoln would have been viewed as a failed president. The North and South would have come to terms over the bifurcation long before 1865, slavery would have continued, and on a firmer foundation than before. White supremacy would have continued to be its bedrock and would have reigned unchallenged throughout the United States. Lincoln's dark warning about all of America becoming a plantation might have proven prophetic in his own lifetime. The Democrats' attempt on America's life is the simple truth about the Civil War that is left out of every historical account and textbook. Progressive historians like Eric Foner and Barbara Fields don't even go near it. Even the most reliable and objective accounts of the war, such as those of James McPherson and Harry Jaffa, at most allude to it. So powerful is the influence of progressive historiography that virtually all accounts of the Civil War succumb to the North-South dichotomy that is at best a partial and oversimplified account of the truth. Once again, the key to the whole truth is the role played by the Northern Democrats. We must begin by noting their indispensable role in any possibility of the